In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Please be seated. I had a grandfather who loved to stump me with trick questions. It seems like every time I saw him, he had a new one to roll out for me. How many months have 28 days? If you answered one, buzz, wrong. All 12 months have 28 days. There's only one who only has 28 days. He got me once with, a rooster laid an egg on top of the barn roof. Which way did it roll? It didn't roll. Roosters don't lay eggs. So my grandfather did this to be silly. But sometimes trick questions are asked with intent to do harm. In the gospel lesson today, Jesus is asked a trick question about taxes. And the purpose is to get him in trouble, to delegitimize him in the eyes of the people, or to get him arrested, or both. Before I get into the tax question, I want to note that there's no easy parallel between the tax Jesus is being asked about and any tax that we pay in the U.S. as citizens today. This is not an income tax, it's not a sales tax, it's not a capital gains tax. The people of Israel had many other taxes to pay besides this one, but the tax Jesus is asked about in this passage is an annual head tax on every subject of Rome. It's a tax on all men from age 14 and women from age 12 to age 65. And the rate was one denarius per year, the equivalent of one day's wages for the average laborer. Jesus is in the temple, and two different groups that do not normally get along or even associate with one another, conspire together to trap him. The Pharisees were members of a religious movement within Judaism, I'm sure many of you are aware, that stressed strict observance of biblical law. They resented Rome's occupation of Israel and considered their worship of foreign gods blasphemy. The Herodians, on the other hand, were also Jews, but Jews who were associated with Rome's puppet king in Israel, Herod. They were Roman collaborators outright, which by definition means they normally flouted the kinds of laws the Pharisees held dear, and they aided the Romans in oppressing the Jewish people. They were widely hated by the peasant masses, the people who were being drawn to Jesus' teaching in droves. The one thing these groups had in common, it seems, was their dislike and distrust of Jesus. So they ask him a question that's designed to get him in trouble, to cut him off at the knees. One in the vein of, have you stopped beating your wife? I mean, if you answer yes, you've admitted you used to beat your wife. If you answer no, you've admitted you're still beating her. Tell us, they challenge Jesus, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? If Jesus says a simple yes, then the Pharisees can accuse him of collaborating with Rome, the great enemy. And they can fracture the relationship between Jesus and his followers. His popularity would vanish in an instant. If Jesus says no, then the Herodians can accuse Jesus of being an insurrectionist and have him arrested, a crime which would be punishable by crucifixion. So in either case, Jesus loses. But Jesus won't be backed into a corner. He asks for a denarius, the coin that was required. That coin, particular coin, was required to pay that particular tax. He asked, whose head is on that coin? The word also is translated image. Whose image is on that coin? His questioners respond, Caesar's. But maybe even more interesting than whose image on the coin are the words on that coin. The coin that was minted during the reign of Tiberius read Tiberius Caesar, August son of the divine Augustus, high priest. For Jews, these words were blasphemous because they amount to calling Caesar the son of God. Jesus knows this and cleverly asks for one of these coins from a Pharisee. Without thinking, apparently, the Pharisee produces a coin. For a Pharisee, to be carrying the coin is a concession, an admission, essentially, of guilt to the sin of blasphemy from one whose whole life supposedly has been devoted to strict adherence to biblical law. Jesus exposes their hypocrisy, and the ones who are trying to trap him have themselves been trapped. Jesus then answers their trick question about taxes in a way that turns the trick on them in at least a couple more ways. He says, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." The first way he's kind of turning it on them is that he's saying basically in this, sure, pay the tax. The money you pay it with is not yours to begin with. Just like the U.S. currency that we carry in our wallets, it's property of the U.S. government. So the denarius was property of Caesar. So go ahead, give it back to him. Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. It was never really yours to begin with. The crowds can still trust him because he's not saying give your allegiance to Rome, and the Herodians can't accuse him of sedition either. It's brilliant. But there's a second way that he turns this trick question on his opponents that day, and that is by adding the second part of the phrase that kind of in our common parlance we just sort of forget. We just say, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and we think that means pay your taxes. But he added a second part. Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and give to God the things that are God's. So what do we give to Caesar? Those things that are stamped with Caesar's image. And what do we give to God? Those things that are stamped with God's image. What is it that's stamped with God's image? Us. All human beings. In the act of creation, in Genesis, God says, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. So what are we to give to God? Our whole selves. Our whole life. With a single phrase, Jesus turns a sparring match into a teaching moment. The gospel says, when they heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. One would have hoped that they would have been convicted by his words, especially the Pharisees, whose passion was for God's law and God's righteousness. One would have hoped that they'd see how their plot to undermine him was not particularly godly. One would hope, but we all know that's not what happened, is it? So what application do these words, this teaching of Jesus, have for us today? It's tempting to interpret this saying, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, in a way that gives us permission to divide up life neatly into discrete piles. All things over here in this pile belong to God, and all things over here in these piles belong to the state or to whatever entity to which we feel responsible, that we owe something. But how would you figure out, if asked and pressed with that question about what belongs to God, how would you figure out which things belong to God? And even more challenging, what are you prepared to say doesn't belong to God? There's an old tale which probably is kind of like a medieval version of an urban legend, but it's still instructive. It's about the Gauls, an ancient and warring tribe of people who inhabited what we now know as France and Belgium. By the 4th and 5th century in the Christian era, the Gauls had come under the influence of the Roman Empire, which by then was itself Christianized. And so Christian missionaries spread throughout Europe and Asia, and the Gauls were converted to Christianity in large numbers. But when the Gauls were being baptized, this legend goes that the missionaries soon noticed they had one very odd behavior. When they were being immersed in the river or stream, they would hold one arm up out of the water, keeping it dry. The missionaries soon learned the reason. When the next battle broke out, the soldier could proclaim, "This arm is not baptized," and grab his club or his axe and go after the enemy with great gusto. No need to hold back. It's kind of like a few years ago during the NBA finals, I declared my living room a Christian-free zone so that I could trash talk the Celtics as much as I wanted. But it doesn't work that way, does it? There is no part of our life that we can declare a Christian-free zone. As I said, this story about the Gauls is most likely a myth. But it speaks to a very real tendency that we have as human beings to want to compartmentalize our lives, to want to live as if our life is something we can place in discrete piles, in which, you know, this pile over here we give to God, and I can do whatever I want with the other piles. But really, it's all God's. What and who we give our time to, what we apply our skills to achieve and do, what we give our money and resources to support and accomplish, even the money we pay in taxes belongs to God, ultimately. So the question becomes not what part is Caesar's and what part is God's, but how do we use whatever we have and whoever we are and whatever power or choice we have to bear the image of God into the world? We pay taxes and think that that's the part we've given to the state, given to Caesar. But as citizens of this country, we have a lot more power than we generally exercise to influence how those taxes are spent. We prefer, though, usually, to abrogate our responsibility and criticize our politicians rather than truly organize and press them to use this money in ways that bear God's image into the world, in ways that promote justice and work for the dignity of all human beings. What portrays God's image into the world is a people who are ingrained in their very being with these words from Jesus: "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. Right one. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Does your speech bear the image of God into the world? Is it kind? Is it loving? Is it harsh, judgmental, thoughtless? Does the way you treat your family bear God's image into the world? Your employees, your coworkers, does your checkbook and the motives that drive your purchases reflect the choices of someone who is making their best effort to give God the things that are God's? Does your pledge and your other giving to your church, does it reflect that? This isn't a trick question. It's a question that deserves a real answer. There is no one right answer for everyone. Only you know how much of you you're giving back to God, that precious and unique gift that God has made you. Only you know how you're spending that. Only you can navigate the complexities of what it means to be a one-of-a-kind mirror into the divine, and how you express that in all of the activities of your living. Only you can discern how to give God what is God's. That is our call, to bear his love and generosity and grace into a world that badly needs it in all we do and are. Amen.